I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Opioid addiction and overdose are public health epidemic with no immediate end in sight. In Massachusetts in 2018, there were 4 deaths every day from opioid overdoses. The National Review reports that 25% of Massachusetts residents have lost a loved one to a fatal opioid overdose. What's been less reported is the tie between opioid addiction and crime. A new study finds that more than half of Americans who have abused opioids have a contact with the criminal justice system. Later in the program, we discuss the drug court model and how it's being used to help those with substance use disorder who end up in the criminal justice system. But first, Sarah Shuey brings us the story of a Bourne family.
Brian Malikas remembers the day well. It was June 2010, late in the afternoon. Brian picked up his mom from work at Bourndale Elementary School.
I took my mother's car. She was a kindergarten teacher and had no idea of anything that I was doing.
We were driving home. We came over the Bourne Bridge, and I said, oh, God, it's a cop at the rotary. And I didn't have an inspection sticker on my car, and I thought, we're going to get pulled over for my sticker.
And sure enough, the cop starts to follow them.
And he turns on the blue lights.
They pull over. Brian said it was like a scene out of a movie.
All of a sudden, there was cops coming out of, like, minivans, and they surrounded us, and they pulled guns on us. And I just remember my mother looking over at me and just kind of, like, screaming, like, Brian, what did you do?
What did you do?
Brian grew up in Bourne, Massachusetts. He had a really happy childhood, played baseball and soccer.
I was in the Cub Scouts for a long time.
Boy Scouts. I was a den mother for 2 years.
They were close. Every year, Brian and his mom decorated the Bourne Library for Christmas. Brian even won an award for his Christmas decorations 1 year.
We call him Mr. Christmas. He used to turn on the switch for the Christmas lights. Every year he'd get to plug it in and they'd do the countdown. It was like a huge thing.
Brian spent a lot of time out on the water with his dad. They'd take the boat out every day after work.
My dad was like my best friend.
But things changed when Brian was 13. His dad got sick. Really sick.
And it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And I guess eventually he went to the doctor. He didn't even tell us. He ended up having lung cancer.
9 months later, he died.
You know, I lost my husband. My son lost his father, you know, at a really, really tough age.
In the years that followed, Brian experimented with drugs. First, it was alcohol. He and his friends took a couple pain pills here and there. Then he had to have surgery on his hand. The doctor prescribed Percocet.
Prescribed 100 Percocets. 100 Percocets to a 16-year-old kid.
That's when Brian got hooked. His family intervened, and he got clean for a year and a half. Then one Christmas, Brian was outside.
And he was out hanging Christmas lights for 2-3 hours. Really, really cold night.
Brian came in the house and was playing with the family dog on the couch. The dog bit his ear.
Like, oh my God. He went in the bathroom and he got a towel and he goes, is it bad? I'm like, oh my God.
The dog had bit off part of Brian's ear. They called 911. Brian took an ambulance to Boston, where doctors were able to surgically reattach most of the ear.
Of course, they gave him opiates.
When the prescription ran out, Brian couldn't stop. His body craved the drugs, so he found ways to get more. That's when the lying started.
I'll never forget the day that he called me and told me he got hit by a car. I was like, oh my God. And then I go into work and I'm telling him they got hit by a car. There was a picture of him on a stretcher. And in one of the papers or something. And I was like, oh, God. And then finding out that wasn't real at all.
In addition to faking hit and runs, Brian would pretend he'd slipped and fallen. He made up other injuries, all to get more pills.
How desperate is that? How desperate is that? That's an addiction.
It got to the point where, you know, I had gone to most of the local hospitals and, you know, you couldn't keep going back, so I started buying them on the street.
Now he was taking 25 to 30 pills a day.
How do you get the money to pay for it? You steal.
I think I even pawned, like, a pair of my mother's earrings or something like that.
Actually, he took the wedding ring, and I think, you know, it would have probably got a couple $100 for it.
At this point, Brian wasn't even getting high anymore. He was using just to feel normal. If Brian didn't take a pill every 45 minutes, he'd start to feel sick and tired, like he had the flu. the anxiety would build.
You're exhausted. You're sweating and you feel like it's 100 degrees.
Your eyes feel like taped open.
The anxiety, your muscles ache, your bones ache.
It feels like you got hit by a truck.
You know, just walking, like you feel every pain until you take that pill. And then that all just kind of goes away.
He'd lost his job. He'd written bad checks. He was desperate.
I pretty much just knew that I needed to get money.
His habit had gone up to $500 a day.
I didn't want to, you know, hurt anybody or anything else like that.
He thought, okay, rob a bank. Seems like a victimless crime. He looked around the house. He found a ski mask and a flare gun. He put on jeans and an Abercrombie sweatshirt and drove to the Sovereign Bank in Plymouth. Inside, he held the flare gun in the air for just a few seconds. He didn't want people to realize it wasn't real.
So give me the money, and next thing I know, there was two tellers throwing the cash up on the counter. I grabbed it and ran.
Brian threw the money into a plastic Stop and Shop bag. He ran back to the car, drove to pay someone for more pills, then picked up his mom from work. And that's when they were pulled over.
And instantly, we were just surrounded by guys that had FBI vests on.
You know, passenger hands out the window and driver hands on the, you know, dashboard. And Brian wasn't, complying. I said, Brian, do it.
I actually had a few pills in the glove box. I just remember, like, almost reaching for it and trying to take them so I wouldn't get sick as fast. But then you see, 15 guns pointed at your head. I'm like, if they see me reach for the glove box right now, this probably isn't going to end well.
The police pulled Brian and Nancy out of the car.
They handcuffed me, asked me if I knew what was going on. I said, I have no idea what's going on. Opened up the back of my car, and they found the money, which I had no idea was in there. I was in shock, and maybe I shouldn't have been in shock. Maybe I should have known, but I didn't.
Brian was sentenced to 7 years in prison for the bank robbery. Nancy stood by him through it all. Brian was transferred to 3 prisons in 7 years. She visited as much as she could.
I don't think I would have gotten through without her.
My son did wrong, but I would never give up on him. I could never. He's my son.
In Bourne, Massachusetts, I'm Sarah Shuey.
Brian was released from prison last fall, spent his first Christmas home in 8 years. That story came from our Transom Story Workshop, led by our production partners at Atlantic Public Media. Today, our topic is drug courts and how they can help those with substance use disorder who find themselves in the criminal justice system. And joining us, Christopher Welch, First Justice in Falmouth District Court. Welcome.
Thank you.
Katie Sugermeyer, Assistant District Attorney in the Barnstable County District Attorney's Office. Good morning to you, Katie.
Good morning.
Allison Wood, Licensed Clinical Social Worker in Fall River.
Good morning.
Lisa Luongo, Certified Drug Court Attorney for Fall River and Taunton.
Good morning.
And Genevieve Enrico, who's an attorney for Falmouth District Court, Drug Court.
Good morning
to you, Genevieve. So Massachusetts has 25 adult drug courts, including those in Barnstable, Fall River, and New Bedford. Judge Welch, you've been instrumental in bringing the one to Falmouth District Court, which is set to open pretty soon in May. Tell us why you lobbied so long and hard for this to come to Falmouth.
I originally started the first drug court when I was sitting in Fall River. I happened to be there. I think I got on the bench about 12 years ago, and my first posting was Fall River. And along the way, the drug court model started arising in our consciousness as the trial court. And I was asked, did I want to start one? And I said, well, I don't know anything about it, but I'll learn. And I started one and then went through the entire graduation. To answer your question, I learned how important it is and how significant it is to try to stop this occurring circle of just crime that doesn't stop because the opiates don't stop. And I got to know a lot of the people, and it simply mattered to me. And I knew, I live on the Cape, and I knew that Falmouth, by media accounts and HBO specials and just talk, had a significant opioid problem. And I thought, maybe I can take the skills I learned in Fall River and bring it to Falmouth. And so that's how it happened.
What percentage of your cases have to do with substance abuse?
I've been in Falmouth now 2 years, and over that course of time, I would say 60 to 70% of the cases are related. Mm-hmm. Now, they're not all drug cases. Right. Many are the typical cases you see with drug addiction, shoplifting, larceny, credit card fraud, things to get short money to buy a bag of dope.
Yeah. Katie, the term drug court can be a little confusing because it happens after an individual goes through the criminal court proceedings. So explain how drug court fits into the criminal justice system.
So the idea behind drug court is that it's good for the probationer that goes on probation and is entered into the drug court. It's essentially a term of probation in which it allows the person to have a more structured environment and allows them to address the underlying issues that they suffer from, which logically makes sense because it's the substance abuse that leads to the crime. And so if you're addressing the substance abuse issues, the thought is that you're going to lower the recidivism rate. So the goal is to rehabilitate the probationer, and in turn, you will reduce the recidivism, which will in turn make the community a more safe environment.
Lisa, drug courts have been around for nearly a quarter century, and the ones in Massachusetts are designed around evidence-based research. Talk us through the different components of the drug court model.
Thank you very much. So I had the privilege of sitting in the Fall River Drug Court with Judge Welch starting February 5th, 2015, and in the Taunton Drug Court with Judge Mathers November 2nd, 2016. So the model works. We have a collaborative team. The team consists of disciplines, the criminal justice discipline. It starts with the judge. We have a probation officer on the team, a district attorney on the team, a defense attorney, myself on the team, a clinician on the team. We have law enforcement on the team sitting around the table. We also have a community person that, like maybe a representative from a treatment facility in Fall River or Taunton that sits around the team. And we have the staffing and the team meetings, and we discuss the National Association of Drug Court Professionals. We follow their model to the team. Because we follow their model, we have very high success rates with the participants that are members of the drug court. My clients all suffer from substance use disorder, and it really reduces recidivism. And also my clients are in treatment. They have urines every single week, three times a week. They go to meetings. They go to counseling. They come to court each and every week, and they have to be transparent. We tell them they have to be honest and show up.
A lot of expectations.
Yeah. And they also understand that this whole team cares about them. And I think that they feel that. And when they come to court, they do very, very well. Yeah.
So how are individuals identified to participate in drug court? What makes them eligible? Anybody?
There is a everything in drug court is evidence-based. And what I mean by that is that there's no one individual who decides, oh, I think this is a good idea. We look at specific criteria to determine if someone is appropriate for drug court. In the drug court criteria, there is a tool that's used, a scoring tool. And a person's asked all these questions, and if they score high into it, the number, then they're in drug court. But it really is people who are high risk of reoffending or high risk of reusing and high need. Mm-hmm. It is oftentimes the person who comes into court and has really not done well on probation is not expected to do well, and oftentimes serves either a straight sentence, no probation, because everybody says, oh, they can't do it. Mm. Or alternatively, they go on probation and fail. So drug court is meant for the people who, but for this last effort, will either be dead or continue cycling through the criminal justice system. It is not for someone who perchance gets arrested the first time and wakes up and says, my goodness,
I'm never going to do this again.
Right. Exactly. It was so scary.
Yeah. Allison, are there any clinical diagnosis or behavioral health issues that would disqualify someone from drug court?
So there are certain criteria for people to be disqualified. Obviously, some of the legal offenses, arson, sex crimes, homicide, those types of extremes. But as far as a mental health side, I have clients who have personality disorders, PTSD, depression, anxiety. You know, there's a wide array. From a mental health standpoint, there's really not any diagnoses that would disqualify them.
And I would think it's probably pretty common when someone has a substance use disorder to have some kind of comorbidity, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, for our clients, if by chance they, prior to their drug use, didn't have any type of a mental health issue, 9 out of 10 of them, if not all of them, have developed, mental health diagnoses just because of the drug use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They've relied on these drugs for so long to tell them when to be up, down, awake, sleep. So then once they've stopped, if they hadn't started with anything, they've definitely ended up with it. This population is very acute. So I don't know many of them who haven't had some type of trauma or,
Learning to relive with yourself all over again, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It is. You know, and then they've been clean. A lot of times we'll see them, around the 90-day mark, they're starting to feel good. But really, their brains haven't even started to heal and get better. I would say until about a year, 15 months, that's when the change actually starts happening. Their brain goes back to close to what it was prior to the drug use. So,
Jennifer, you're new to the drug court. So tell us your why you want to be part of this. What has led you to this?
Thank you. So I am a resident in Falmouth, long-term resident in Falmouth. Professional background began in the Cape and Islands District Attorney's Office as a prosecutor just when drug courts were starting to surface in the trial court. And so had a little bit of exposure as a prosecutor, but nothing like what Katie's done now. And then working as an attorney in the community, when Judge Welsh approached me and asked me to be part of the team, I knew immediately that it was something that I wanted to do both professionally and as an individual who has experienced. I don't know if there's anybody who does live in our area who hasn't been touched by the crisis that is upon us. And so it was just a brilliant opportunity to really hope that I could maybe help with this team.
Is there a limit to the number a drug court can serve?
It really is a function of the supervision of the individual. It is so intense, especially in the beginning, when someone walks in for the first time. The probation officer will, and clinician and attorney, will be meeting with these people constantly. The level of supervision is so high because you go to home visits, they have visits in the probation department. So really, the max number depends upon the ability to do the job correctly and apply those standards that through the National Association. So is there a firm number? Maybe 20 to 30, somewhere in there. It could be a little higher.
So I'm seeing some heads nod around the table.
Yeah, about 20 to 30. And, the program is in phases. So if a person's in phase one, we see them every week. Mm-hmm. And then as they go on, the goal is they come over time, over 18 months, less and less and less till the end where they are flying on their own, but yet still in drug court for purposes of testing. Testing never stops till the day you graduate. Mm-hmm. And so if you have a lot of people in phase 5 or 4, they're not coming as much. So you could probably add some people in. But really the idea is I have to do the supervision level for these people or they will not make it. And so that's really what dictates the numbers. Mm-hmm.
We are talking about drug courts and how they can help those with substance use disorder who find themselves in the criminal justice system. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about drug courts. In studio with us is Christopher Welch, First Justice in Falmouth District Court, Katie Sugarmeyer, Assistant DA at the Barnstable County DA's office, Allison Wood, licensed clinical social worker in Fall River, Lisa Luongo, certified drug court attorney for Fall River and Taunton, and Genevieve Enrique, attorney for Falmouth District Court, Drug Court. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626 if you have a comment or question for us. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So what kinds of addiction treatment options are there for individuals who are not eligible for drug court and are serving jail time?
For participants who aren't involved with drug court or they don't qualify, you know, anyone can get themselves into a detox. They can get themselves into a dual diagnosis, whether it's on the Cape or off the Cape, you know, Gosnold, Star, which is off the Cape, High Point, you know, crisis centers, hospital emergency rooms. Clients can, you know, people can go there and seek out those types of services. And from a detox or a dual diagnosis is like a detox, except they'll also get someone on medications for mental health diagnoses as well. So from there, they can usually go to what's called a step-down program, which allows them to wait there for a long-term treatment, like a residential halfway house, a sober house. Typically the higher level of care on a continuum of care is a halfway house. You know, a lot more structure. They provide random drug screens. They have a lot of requirements in the home. And once somebody completes those are about 3 months to 6 months. Sometimes there's some programs for about a year. All of them are really different and they're all over the state. But then if the person wishes, they can go then to a sober house, which has a lot less restrictions.
We have our reporter, Sarah Mises-Tan, who's actually doing a series of reports on sober houses, halfway houses right now. And I think, Judge, we've talked about you know, there's good and bad, right? I mean, and there's quite a few, obviously, here in Falmouth because we have a lot of, you know, we have Gosnold and treatment happening here. So, you know, how do you know if you're getting in a good one?
That's a tough question, only because the sober house industry is an unregulated industry in the state. And as a result, from house to house, and I talk to probationers about this all the time. They'll tell me, Judge, I'm doing great. I'm in a sober house. And I'm quite frank with them. And I'll say, well, you know, is it a good one or is it one of those? And they will undoubtedly just, yeah, they'll laugh and go, well, no, it's not one of those. Yeah, we have meetings, we have testing, we have curfews, we have accountability. And you're right, it is something of the luck of the draw. And they can change overnight because there can be a great manager of a house and then someone can come in who is not. And so that is certainly troublesome because you, in good faith, people come to Gosnold to get treatment. And then they, in good faith, get out of the inpatient and they're here and they go to a sober house. Now, Gosnold will, of course, put you in a sober house that is appropriate and well run. But some people come here to a sober house and they don't know. And then it doesn't work out for them. The police are recently making statistics on the overdoses that occur in sober houses. So I think that statistic that they're creating evidences the problem.
Sorry, if I may. There are also some sober houses that are what's called MASH certified. And those are monitored a bit more closely. They have to upkeep the regulations set forth by MASH. So those oftentimes will set apart from a sober house that just somebody started up. So, you know, that is something that people can search for as well. And with drug courts, we try to get people into MASH certified sober housing, as well as, I'm sure, you know, the big treatment centers. So
one thing you did that you asked about was how a person, and Allison talked about the mental health aspect and treatment. If a person is on probation, we generally start them off with a treatment evaluation, any treatment deemed necessary, and random testing. And that's it. And we see how they do. If they do not do well, then probation reacts with an adjustment of treatment or things like that. Again, the drug court model is really for those people who will not be able to do it on their own through probation without the intense supervision that drug court team gives to them.
You wanted to say something?
I wanted to say something about the MASH certified sober houses. Mm-hmm. So my clients that finish a residential program, a 3 to 6 month residential program, they will be authorized to go to a MASH certified sober house. There are sober houses for males, and then there are sober houses for females. And those MASH certified sober houses are very good. They have to be transparent. The manager of that sober house is required to let the judge know how my participant is doing in the program, and they have to be honest and transparent. And because of that relationship between the sober houses and the drug courts, it keeps them, everybody, honest. And so before we have a relapse.
Katie, can you explain the differences between probation for a drug court participant versus someone not going through the drug court?
Yes. So there's different types of probation. Someone that is in drug court, it's much more structured. You're going to see a probation officer much more frequently. You're going to be in front of the judge much more frequently. It's going to provide you many more resources than traditional probation would provide you, because the idea is that this individual, because they suffer from a substance use disorder, needs more structure, needs more opportunities to better themselves so that they can become a productive member of society. So they offer parenting classes, they offer ways to help them get employment, to become an employable human being. They offer groups. They offer regular testing. So someone in drug court may be tested more frequently than someone on regular probation. As the judge said, someone that's just on standard probation and not drug court probation, it would be an very basic probationary period in which you would, yes, be drug and alcohol free with screens, but your screening, like I said, would be less frequently. You'd undergo a substance abuse evaluation and comply with any treatment that came out of that, but you're not going in front of the judge as frequently, and there's less programming because the people that are in drug court, as the judge said, are very high risk to overdose or reoffend. The idea of drug court is to provide so much structure and so many resources that when the person ultimately graduates after completing all the stages, they likely will not commit crime again, which, like I said before, makes a safer community.
Yeah. Allison, drug courts have been described as therapeutic jurisprudence. Would you think it's a type of therapy? It sounds like it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, whether a person starts off drug court on an outpatient basis, doing outpatient therapy, intensive outpatient groups, you know, they're still doing some type of treatment every day of the week. You know, if they're on an inpatient basis at a halfway house, you know, we're still requiring that they receive individual therapy. You know, a lot of them, again, on psychiatric medication, so making sure that they're adhering to their medications, being compliant with their medications, seeing their psychiatrists, and, you know, making it to all of their appointments. So it is extremely therapeutic.
Yeah. And I also see that their behaviors need to change, so they get CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, or MRT, which is
motor recognition therapy.
Motor recognition therapy, and the participants that I represent, they respond to this in kind. They're able to talk about what's troubling them, why they might have a relapse. They'll talk about that in these groups. And before they have a relapse, so they don't have that relapse.
Also, what are some of the behaviors that are common in those with substance use disorder that are addressed in drug court? I'm thinking lack of self-esteem, then we've heard about the lying that we heard in our setup piece. There's some common things, right? Common behaviors?
Right. So obviously, you know, they have to be very manipulative in order to get their needs met. You know, they lie to their family, they lie to their children, things that they do to their families and children, and co-workers, and just really anyone. There's no limit. You know, they do whatever they need to do to not feel sick. You know, the lying, manipulating. You know, we've had clients who have faked families, members passing away. You know, it's really, there's no limit to what they'll do.
Well, we heard in the story, Brian sold his mother's wedding ring.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, yeah.
Yeah. You hear a lot of stories.
Well, as Alice had said, there was, I'll be very brief with it, as a young fella, and he got to the podium, and he started crying about his father and his mother breaking up, and he was going to take care of his father's in the hospital. Next week, crying at the podium. Dad's really sick. I have to be the one to pull the plug. Next week, in the podium, I had to pull the plug, and then they'll be awake. And, of course, I believe it was Lisa.
Yes, I represented this participant.
Who found yes. out there was no wake. Mm. Dad's alive. Mm. And that was a lesson to me as to the depth of deception that is ingrained in the person. And that would go across various things. I would have drug tests on someone that were confirmed 3 times. Mm. And they'd stand in front of you and say, I did not use. And then one time, it was the 4th week, and I kept going at him, and he finally said, oh, I used. Mm. And I looked at him, and I said, why would you not say it a month ago? I don't know, Judge. I just lie. Mm-hmm. And that was a great day because right. it was a breakthrough for him. But the behavior that they get into of lying, it becomes a norm.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's not lying anymore. It's, mm-hmm. it is lying, but they don't
survive.
I don't think they see it yeah. as lying. I don't know. Yeah. It's very complicated.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. So how often does the drug court team meet to talk about the progress of individuals? And 'cause you're talking, here we have this guy's getting up there lying till the 4th time. And we're talking about being transparent and following the rules. And so as you're saying, we need a lot of like resources and structure and all that. How often does this team get together and go over each individual case?
So the team meets once a week. We have a staffing meeting and in Fall River, it is on Thursday mornings, and then we go right into the session where the participants come and they speak with the judge in Taunton there Wednesday mornings. We talk about the participants as long as we need to service their needs, to service their treatment, to discuss any issues that they bring up, to discuss their treatment, as I said. So that the team meetings are once a week. However, it is for me a 24 hour a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year job for me. Mm. And I just love it.
Yeah. Well, and when you see the success stories, obviously, I mean, you know, this is a tough road for these folks who are in recovery, as we know.
As Allison was saying earlier, that the participants will lie, cheat, and steal mm-hmm. to their families and friends. By the time my participant is graduating from drug court, the relationships have now mended between their loved ones, mothers, fathers, siblings, children, and now those family members are now trusting their mm-hmm. Child and allowing them back into the home. I represent some participants that haven't been invited to Thanksgiving dinner or Christmas dinner for 6 years in a row. And once they are successful in drug court, they're starting to get invited back into the house and mm-hmm. celebrate the Thanksgiving or Christmas with their family members. And I love it when they get up to the podium and they tell the judge and they can see the happiness in their mm-hmm. face, how they're welcomed back into the family home.
Yeah. We're talking about drug courts. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about drug courts and how they can help those with substance use disorder who find themselves in the criminal justice system. In studio with us is Christopher Welch, First Justice in Falmouth District Court, Katie Sugarmeyer, Assistant District Attorney at the Barnstable County District Attorney's Office, Allison Wood, Licensed Clinical Social Worker in Fall River, Lisa Luongo, Certified Drug Court Attorney for Fall River and Taunton, and Genevieve Enrique, Attorney for Falmouth District Court, Drug Court. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have an email it's signed from a crisis worker. I work for emergency service team, and I'm glad you spoke about lack of placements. Ask your panel about the rules with hospitals that people who show up looking for help have to leave if placement can't be found in 24 hours. Also, placements will not give people their medication as medical medication if it's a narcotic, even if it's not abused and needed, which makes it more difficult to get proper treatment. I think your panel is painting a broad picture of treatment services. Sober houses, even MASH placements, still kick people out. Step downs are not guaranteed. Much more is needed. Thoughts on that?
So prior to my working with the Fall River and New Bedford drug courts, I was a crisis worker as well. So, you know, we did oftentimes run into all of these little niches and walls, you know. Again, this is where their manipulation and, you know, getting their needs met came in, because, you know, they could come in looking for a detox bed or a dual diagnosis bed. And if there were none, they had to go. So then oftentimes they would ratchet up, you know, they were suicidal. So then they'd finally, you know, be able to go somewhere they could stay. So it is very difficult. You know, it's not as easy as just getting a detox bed or a dual diagnosis bed. Halfway houses have extremely long wait lists, hence why, you know, the step downs are very important. It's always a good thing. It doesn't always happen, but when these people have family members that can drive them, you know, to the crisis center every day, or they can drive them, you know, to the STAR or treatment center that, you know, just to check in, are there any beds today? Mm-hmm. It is very difficult, you know.
Yeah, so the folks who are coming through the drug court who have this structured, form that they have to adhere to, do they have any kind of priority for beds, or are they in the same situation as that? You're shaking your head, Judge. Yeah. Or are they in the same situation just because you say, okay, they need this, do they get it, or how does that work?
I think oftentimes we're faced with frankly, a person who comes in and needs an inpatient bed. And the good work of people like Allison and Lisa and any and all hands on deck call around. Mm-hmm. And it really is a function of, is there a bed available? Because like in Barnstable, you have Barnstable Drug Court. You now have Wareham. You have New Bedford and Fall River. And so the Southeast Corridor, it didn't exist before. So now there's all these drug courts reaching out to whatever placement they can make. And it, of course, because of the numbers, it falls short. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes would have to wait. And that gets tricky, mm-hmm. because you very deep. I'm obviously everyone here is, but I'm very deeply concerned. If we don't tend to this, this can go bad.
Right.
And so I think there isn't a priority because every drug court is looking for the same thing, mm-hmm. and we're all going to the same trough. Mm. Yeah.
There are a few programs, I would say, that they do have like separate wait lists, like North Cottage. They're phenomenal. They actually have clients on a drug court list, so they do take mm-hmm. priority. There's a few other programs that will do that.
Because these are high risk. These are the high risk people
we're
talking about. Yeah.
Very high risk. But more often, you know, like Judge Welch said, there's no priority. You mm-hmm. know, they're just mixed in with, you know, anyone else.
How far into the drug court process do you typically start to see changes in behavior?
I think everyone's different. You know, I think it depends on where they are in their journey. When did they start using? What do they have for supports? We've had participants who, you know, they go through the program with not a blemish, mm-hmm. you know, and we have people who are good until the third phase. There's five phases, you know, and it takes them, you know, triple the amount of time in phase three that it would someone else. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone's different.
So is there a point where you don't see progress that you say, oh, this isn't working for you? I mean, because obviously it doesn't work for everybody, right?
Well, that's a tough one. I hesitate to have anyone leave drug court not graduating. However, there are a number of factors. If a person commits a new crime, mm-hmm. that will probably get you taken out of drug court, except for something like possession of heroin,
right.
because that's why they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And then if someone just, it's not happening, we err on I, because I'm the one who's going to make the decision. I err on the side of caution and I keep trying. And when I decide and the team gives me input, this is the team. That's mm-hmm. the approach. The team will at one point come to the realization that this person really isn't, even at this stage, ready. Mm-hmm. And it, you have to worry because you don't want that person infecting the whole group. And so there's a that factor involved. So you have an individual's needs, but you have the need of the group. Mm-hmm. And if that person is bringing the group down in that they do not meet anything, then the group begins to wonder right. what's going on. And then at that point, usually treatment, defense counsel, everyone will say, you know, we don't think for John it's working at this point, maybe at some other time.
Yeah. And you talked about, like, you know, we were talking about the getting the family reunions and the success stories and how happy they are. But relapse is common, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that happens. Mm-hmm. So, and there are probably some other mistakes that are made along the way. So how much of a, you know, leeway do you have to make some mistakes along the way?
I never give up on any of my participants. My motto is the only way out of drug court is to graduate from drug court. Treatment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When a person has a team of people to help them succeed, you would think that probably is going to influence their self-esteem, right? So do you have an example of that? Anybody have an example of I mean, you know, you've got a lot of clients. I mean, you must see that in the ones that graduate, right? We see their self-esteem improves. And
oh, absolutely. The way they carry themselves. You can see it in their shoulders when they're standing in front of the judge and speaking with the judge. You can see it in the smiles on their faces. You can see it in their eyes, how they light up. So this, and you can tell, you can just feel it. It's an energy in the room that they exuberate when they're doing really, really well and they feel proud of themselves. They've had a very good week. They might get an incentive. An incentive might be a $5 Dunkin' Donuts card or a bottle of shampoo or a prayer book or an AA book, whichever they pick their choosing, or a prayer stone.
And
or
does that come from the team?
Yes.
Where does that come from? Yeah.
It's an interesting thing. When I started Fall River, they told me, and we went to Georgia, in fact, and watched a drug court because they the National Association will send you to a model court. And in this model court, there was this big basket full of stuff, you know, socks, books, you know, T-shirts, sweatshirts, things like that. And a person would come to the podium. And I have heard this from many a participant. And if they were doing well, and this sounds to me when I first saw it, I thought it was silly. I didn't get it. And then I saw it in action, and I saw the joy and pride that a person had when you'd say, you know, you have had a great week. Look what you did. Mm-hmm. And so let's get to the basket and pick something. I've heard from many participants, if they didn't get invited to that basket, it was a sorry day for them, but they felt it. Yeah. To that end, when a person comes into drug court, and sadly the person, and we find out what was the onset of drug use, when did it start? The youngest, sadly, was 8. The average, 15, 14, mm-hmm. 15, things like that. If that drug gets into you when you're 14 or 15, your brain develops around it. And so if I get you at 22, you have 7 years of that, you know, redefining your brain, the circuitry. Mm-hmm. And it takes time. Yeah. So when the person comes in, if they're 22, they're still 15. Mm. And you see a 15-year-old. And the 15-year-old grows up in front of your eyes. Yeah. Where they start using adult language. But when they start, they stomp their feet, they're angry, they speak in a juvenile manner. Mm-hmm. But as they move through the program, the sentence structure changes, the posture changes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've had people come into drug court, they're lying on the ground.
Yeah.
They're in the court, lying there. They can't get up because they say there's all these physical problems. And then they're in front of you 18 months later, standing tall, going to a gym, because to graduate from drug court, you have to have a job, you have to have a safe place to live, you have to have been working on a lot. They're different. Mm. The person they were meant to be starts coming out.
What a fascinating transformation.
It's amazing to see. You really do see it.
Unfortunately, there are people who die from overdose while in drug court. How often are the signs there that this is coming, or is it a complete surprise? And we talked earlier about the manipulation. So, and how often does that happen?
Too often.
Yeah.
I experienced that for my first time in Fall River, and I was panicked. It was really sad. It was who was our first? That do you remember?
Mr. Carvalho.
Right. And then, I mean, a lot of times, you know someone's struggling, but one of them was leaving a meeting on his way back to the halfway house and ran into somebody. And his chops weren't strong enough yet. He was in the beginning. Nice kid in the beginning and used once, and he was dead.
Yeah.
And dealing with that, I found I don't know. It's so difficult because then, you know, the whole team is devastated, but we must keep going on. And then the group is now suffering from that as well, because all of these people know each other, especially during the course of it. They become friends. And so we have to address it and move through it. And on to the next treatment.
So we mentioned these are very high risk people go through this. And the scientific community has put drug courts under a microscope and concluded that drug courts significantly reduce drug abuse and crime and do so at far less expense than any other justice strategy. So what are your thoughts on why drug courts work so well? Is it that team approach? Is it because there's so much structure?
I think it's because of the super intense structure of the team, probation. They have to come into court every single week for the first few months. And they have face-to-face conversations with their probation officers. They have face-to-face conversations with the judge at the podium. They have to speak with the clinician. The district attorney's office is involved. Law enforcement is involved. They see that law enforcement cares. In Fall River and in Taunton, we have an opioid crisis team. They're out on the streets. They're very helpful. I think that the stigma of we're hoping to reduce the stigma of substance abuse disease. And I think that's why, because of the super intense treatment that these participants are getting, and they're required for the first time to be honest and to show up. They're encouraged to be honest, to show up. They have to be honest. They have to show up. They have to be transparent. They're really changing their behaviors. Because they're changing their behaviors, that's why it's being successful.
Yeah. We only have about a minute left, but Judge, I want to ask you, one of the things we've been talking about this crisis for a while, and you keep thinking, well, is it going to get better? And really, the statistics are not really showing that it's really improving all that much, right?
No, as I said to you this morning, unfortunately, I did get statistics from the Falmouth PD that indicates that as of this month, the overdose rate has up 109%. The death rate is up 400%. Narcan use is up 140%.
Yeah, and is that, so, those Massachusetts?
April 7th, 2019, Falmouth Police Department.
Just Falmouth. Wow.
And that, it's daunting.
Yeah.
The amount of unnecessary death.
And of course, drug court is going to begin in Falmouth mid-May.
I think that's when our clinician will become available and we will launch.
Yeah, we'd love to hear how it works out, and hopefully we'll have lots of good results. Christopher Welch, Katie Sugarmeyer, Allison Wood, Lisa Luongo, and Genevieve Enrique, thank you all for being here, and thank you so much for the work that you do.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.